This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You call this a weak economy?
FedEx is expecting today will be its busiest day ever.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, December 12th.
Coming up, what can FedEx tell us about the broader economy?
What's next for the UK after the country decided not to sign on to the new plan to save Europe?
And opening a savings account for your kid these days may not offer the same lessons as it did back in the day.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Today, FedEx is expecting to ship 17 million packages just today. Now, that would be up from last year's peak of 15.6 million in a single day, and it'll be the busiest day in the company's 40-year history.
Julia Coronado is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us from New York, as she is every Monday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Julia, how is it possible that in this relatively weak economy that FedEx is about to have its busiest day ever?
Well, I think that it reflects a pretty significant trend away from shopping in stores to shopping online. And in fact, we know that consumers actually now go to the stores, pick out what they want, and then go and find the best deal possible online. The second thing it reflects is that people are buying more electronics this Christmas season and fewer clothing items. So that means you don't have to try on an electronic. You can just pick what you want and order it online.
Now, we often look to these big companies, these big shipping companies like FedEx and UPS for messages about how the broader economy is doing because they sort of have this front row seat to trade between people and between companies. What is the broader message here, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that the overall picture is a little more mixed than just looking at the FedEx report. If we look at, say, for example, port data that tracks all the things coming into the U.S., that actually shows a more subdued picture. So, again, I think the online manufacturers and retailers are doing well, but consumers are overall very price sensitive and still on the cautious side. And one thing that they are also doing is shifting a little bit more towards domestically produced goods. And that's particularly true in the auto sector. And we certainly see auto manufacturers picking up, the domestic auto manufacturers picking up market share. So you get a little bit less coming from overseas, a little more purchased here at home.
Julia Coronado is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Julia, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
Well, in St. Paul, Minnesota this month, the last Ford Ranger pickup truck is expected to roll off the assembly line. We'll be saying adios, partner, is that, to the Ranger.
Is the Ranger is the Ranger Hispanic?
No, the Ranger, the West, you know, the Wild West.
The old Wild West.
Yeah, yeah. I want to hear some music now. Okay. Ford is sending the Ranger off into the sunset in part because people want bigger trucks, Jeremy. And our Marketplace business correspondent Bob Moon explains why.
Ford has seen small truck sales drop from 8 to just 2% of the market, and spokesman Mike Levine says you can't argue with the numbers.
We've put our investment where we have the most demand, and that's for full-size pickups.
Rewind to just this past April, though. President Obama was chiding gas-guzzling drivers for complaining about high prices.
They're all still driving their big SUVs. You know, they got their big monster trucks and everything.
IHS automotive analyst Rebecca Lindland says that push to smaller cars actually ended this summer right on cue based on past experience.
Consumers typically will change their buying habits when there is a spike in fuel prices. After 3 to 4 months, we will see the consumer go back to their traditional buying habits.
Ford's Mike Levine says smaller trucks just aren't attracting buyers the way they used to.
Their fuel economy is the same, if not worse, than full-size trucks. Also, the prices of mid-sized trucks, along with their sizes, have grown to be almost full-size proportions.
Levine says Ford is committed to giving consumers the vehicles they want through improved fuel economy. But analyst Lindland says developing new gas-saving technology is expensive, so buyers should be ready to pay more. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
American Airlines parent firm AMR is expected in U.S. bankruptcy court today in New York. And going forward, not only will American have to negotiate with creditors, it'll also have to figure out what to do with its big pension plan.
Now, one possibility is that American would turn its employee pensions over to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. That's the PBGC, Jeremy, that was set up by the federal government back in the 70s, as a matter of fact, as an independent agency to safeguard against employees losing their pensions when a company goes bankrupt or goes under completely. Josh Gottbaum is director of the PBGC, and he's with us now to talk about it. Good morning, sir.
Morning. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing well. Will American Airlines eventually turn over their pensions, do you think, in their bankruptcy over to you guys?
No one knows for sure yet, but it's pretty clear that they're thinking about it. And that's enough to engage us.
Engage you? Like, are you troubled by that? Do you think you can cover it?
The job of the PBGC is when companies can't take over their plans to step in and make sure that people get a pension. However, it is always better for employees to get the plan that their employer originally promised them for two reasons. One is we don't cover health benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And two is there's a dollar maximum on the pension that we can pay. And as it happens, airline pensions are very often go above our dollar maximum.
I want to talk a little bit about your corporation. It's sort of a corporation that's charged with being a backstop, but you may need a backstop too because your agency is already in a pretty big hole, right? There's a possibility that you guys might even need a taxpayer bailout.
The way we pay our benefits is we, like insurance companies, we charge premiums to pension plans. And unfortunately, the history has been that those premiums have been determined by the Congress and they have been too low. So what has happened every couple of years is we have gone to the Congress and said, look, the premiums are too low. The PBGC deficit is getting larger. You got to raise the premiums. And more than a dozen times in the 37 years we've been in existence, Congress has said, yes, we're going to raise them. And we think that's going to continue to happen.
What is it going to do to the agency if you have to take on American Airlines pensions? I mean, an agency that's already, like, having to tighten its belt.
If we take over Americans' pensions, we're going to pay those benefits. We will, as we've already done, go back to the Congress and say, Congress, do the right thing and let PBGC set realistic premiums.
Josh Gottbaum, director of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Mr. Gottbaum, thank you.
Glad to help.
Now to the marketplace global perspective, French President Nicolas Sarkozy said this morning that the legal details of Friday's Euro summit deal will be coming in the next couple of weeks.
The deal aims to keep the Euro together by allowing a central authority to enforce budget rules for individual countries. Tim Loinag is chief economist with the London think tank Center Forum. He joins us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, are economists like you waking up across Europe this morning thinking the leaders of Europe are getting this euro crisis under control?
Well, we're seeing that they're doing their best, but I think it's far too early to say that they've got it under control.
Now, this treaty that was sort of figured out on Friday and last week was about austerity. It's about cutting budgets, making sure that individual European countries keep their finances in order. But I wonder what it means for growth in the future. If these governments around Europe are going to have to stick to these limits, will they be able to grow their economies?
Well, exactly. It's really not clear to me that you want to be Greece, Italy, Spain, or even France today, because your countries have signed up to austerity as far as we can see into the future. That's not a really very good prospect.
Well, what do they do about that?
Well, I wouldn't have signed had I been them, and I'm not sure this deal will actually stick. It might stick for a few months because people know there's a crisis, but I doubt it's going to stick for a few years.
But could they have gotten past the immediate crisis without signing something like this?
Well, you can only have a single currency if the countries that do best agree to behave reasonably. Britain behaved reasonably in the gold standard in the 19th century, but Germany is not behaving reasonably now. Germany needs to refloat its economy, get money out there, which will float not only its own economy, but the rest of Europe. If it doesn't do that, the euro is doomed sooner or later.
Tim Loinag, chief economist at the London think tank Center Forum, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, one country that famously is not signing on to the deal, the European deal, is the United Kingdom. And today, Prime Minister David Cameron will tell lawmakers why, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
By turning its back on its European neighbors, Britain protected some of its short-term interests.
They don't take on any financial obligation, any oversight of their own fiscal affairs.
Gary Huffbauer is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says Britain benefited by not having to chip in for a bailout fund. Also, the Brits didn't like the Euro deal's potential for new regulations and a possible tax on financial transactions. London's financial center is as big as or bigger than New York's.
It is a major industry in London, and it is a powerhouse in the world, and the British are not going to give that up.
What the British do give up is influence over European affairs. And Huffbauer says the decision could come back to haunt the UK.
If Britain comes up on hard times, it will not be able to look to Europe for help.
Going forward, Britain still needs to negotiate with the continent about everything from trade to immigration. And some of the spurned European leaders will likely be looking for payback. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Well, today China is holding what's considered the country's most important economic summit of the year. Leaders will be talking about the weak economy here in the U.S. as well as the debt crisis in Europe. But as our former China correspondent Scott Tong tells us, the big focus will be on the domestic economy in China.
For Beijing, priorities 1, 2, and 3 are growth, growth, and growth. Not so long ago, China worried about overheating. But now things have slowed down, in part because of soft exports to a weak eurozone. So the government this week will turn to stimulus ideas. What's on the menu? Perhaps pushing banks to lend more to businesses. Perhaps targeted government spending on low-income farmers. Economist Albert Keidel at the Atlantic Council says the long view is to make Chinese companies and people wealthier, so they import more stuff from us.
The U.S. could continue to sell machinery and technology to them, which is what they really need to continue to grow. So if they're successful in enhancing growth in a lot of their sectors, it would help U.S. exports.
Right now, the typical Chinese person makes about $7,500 a year, not high by global comparison. Of course, spending more money carries a risk of inflation. That's long been a recipe for political instability in China. One year, meat prices rose, Chinese struggled to get by, and they demonstrated. That was 1989, the year of Tiananmen Square. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is in Washington today. His White House visit comes as American troops prepare to leave that country by the end of the year. So what does the future hold for relations between our two nations and for the economy of Iraq? The BBC's Jim Muir is with us now from Baghdad. He has the latest on that story. Hey, Jim.
Hi there.
What will the U.S. presence, do you think, look like after January 1st? And I'm talking about how much money that the U.S. pours into Iraq.
Well, certainly it's, although the last troops are on the way out and will be gone certainly before the end of the year, that doesn't mean an end of the whole story or the U.S. presence here. There's going to be an embassy that will be the biggest in the world with something like 15, 16,000 people. Some of them, a small number, like 150 or so, will be military trainers who will be working closely with the Iraqi military, plus several hundred private contractors doing the same kind of thing. So there will still be Americans around, but they'll certainly be way more visible than they were in the earlier years, up until, say, a couple of years ago, when it was quite common to see American troops in the streets doing patrols, doing checkpoints and things. That's already in the past.
And certainly Iraq needs the United States for economic help, right?
For economic help, less so for economic help, I would say, than for military help or strategic help. Economically, they're producing something like 2.9 million barrels of oil a day. So they've got money. It's not so much just money that they need. It's more, for example, training. They want to buy as many as 36 F-16s, for example. That's not just something that you take delivery of and start flying around in. They need a lot of training. It's going to be some years before they get them fully operational and have anything like the capacity to defend their own airspace or their borders. So it's really that external defense capability that is missing at the moment, as well as perhaps intelligence operations and so on against what both sides call terrorism. So there's a lot of ways in which they will be looking to America for help, less, I would say, just in terms of financial handouts than of expertise and some kind of strategic bolstering.
The BBC's Jim Muir in Baghdad. Jim, thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Well, talking about things going on here at home, Jeremy, a Florida man left a lot of money and his home to Uncle Sam after he passed away, all in an effort to reduce the nation's debt. That was nice, right?
Wow.
James Davidson's home was just sold at auction over the weekend, bringing in almost $1.2 million. He also gave $1 million cash to the cause. The U.S. debt stands at $15 trillion. So thanks to Mr. Davidson, that's now $14,999,997,800,000 and a few cents. Oh, wait, we just passed $15 trillion just now.
Oh, yeah. Steve, just, you know, but he made his mark for a moment.
No, I'm just saying, yes, but,
nice
but it doesn't take very long for that total.
That's
to,
true.
To
it's
keep
going up,
up
pretty
yeah,
fast.
It's like that clock over there in New York, right?
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
If you look at the latest data from the Labor Department, you'll find a couple of things, Steve. Number one, not enough jobs are being created, obviously. Mm-hmm. We know that, especially for young people. They're having a particularly hard time. And productivity is going up, which means we're all working harder and maybe getting a little more stressed out.
Yeah.
Those two things, put them together, and it might explain why more college grads are choosing careers in yoga. Hmm. Sarah Gross reports.
Inhale deeply and fill your lungs with air.
This class in New York City may seem like a typical yoga session.
Exhale all of the breath out.
Except that what you hear is the sound of student debt being worked off. Maya McGinnis is teaching the class. She's 26 and found herself in the thick of the economic meltdown after graduating from Duke University in 2007. She had wanted to pursue a career in finance, but after months without work, she enrolled in a yoga teacher certification class.
At that point, I don't think it was really my intention to become a full-time yoga teacher, but during that training, the seed was planted.
As many as 30 million people in the U.S. practice yoga, and there are some 70,000 teachers. The Bureau of Labor Statistics predicts that number will jump 30% within the decade.
We've seen a huge increase in the number of younger students applying to our teacher trainings.
Andrew Tanner heads the teaching program at Kripalu Yoga Center in Weston, Massachusetts.
From 2008 to 2011, there's been more than a 70% increase in the number of 18 to 25-year-olds.
Teaching yoga can be fairly lucrative. Instructors can get between $25 and $100 an hour for group classes, considerably more for private lessons. But for McGinnis, at least, it's not just about the money.
It's both financially sustainable and also sustainable for your soul. I think there are many other careers out there that sort of eat away at people, and you can see it in their face.
And although yogis have traditionally been older, capable of teaching life lessons along with poses, McGinnis believes that her youth affords her some advantages.
Especially given that I am a newer teacher, you get people that say, oh, you might not have enough life experience. But then once they've taken my class, I think that I provide a very fresh perspective.
With more people McGinnis' age teaching yoga, it's a perspective that could be coming to a yoga studio near you. I'm Sarah Gross for Marketplace.
This could be the best week for initial public offerings in many months, Jeremy, thanks in part to Zynga.
Hmm.
The online gaming company is the largest maker of games on Facebook. You, I know, have seen them. Farmville
sure,
is probably
them.
A very famous one. And you've, yeah, stop Farmville-ing me. On
I'm not a Farmville person,
know
Steve.
You
know
I'm
that.
Just kidding. But Zynga hopes to raise as much as $1 billion when it begins selling stock this week.
Well, in today's Midday Extra, we ask, can Zynga help bring back the tech IPO, which I guess was destroyed in part by Groupon's collapse after they went public. Yeah. Not collapse completely, but stock price not looking too great right now. Here to talk to us is Dan Hsu, editor of Bitmob.com. He's with us now. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Well, what do you think is going to come out of this IPO at Zynga? Is this going to bring back the tech IPO?
Well, there's certainly a lot of people watching this very closely and excited about it and talking about it for a while. You know, and I've also talked to a few people who are not as excited, you know, about it. They think it's maybe it's a little bit evaluated high. But I mean, I certainly know from my own experience that their games can be very addicting. I'm getting dozens of requests every day for games like their new one, which is Castleville, from a lot of people, game industry people that I know, game developers, hardcore gamers, casual gamers. So I know their games are certainly very, very popular.
I know, you know, we talk, Dan, about like the tech bubble from the late 90s, early 2000s, right? I mean, is Zynga worth it? $1 billion?
I don't know what they're going to do with all that money. Looking at it from the game side, from the game industry side, I kind of think that, you know, obviously Zynga is very ambitious. They have a lot of new products that they're still bringing out that are they've announced that have not come out yet. They want to get into the mobile. That was very clear from their last press conference. They definitely have big plans. They're hiring a lot of people. At the same time, though, you look at a lot of their games, and they follow a very distinct formula. One of their tactics is to just change a little bit of artwork. It requires very little effort on their part, and they instantly make money because they know there are thousands of people willing to shell out money for a new colored jet plane or horse or something like that in their games. Some of their upcoming games coming out aren't as exciting to me. I don't think they have as much widespread appeal. And I wonder if that's going to factor in a lot, you know, because, and again, like what I said earlier, that a lot of their products are very similar. I wonder if there's also a little bit of Zynga fatigue, because I know I played a lot of their games. You know, I'm certainly addicted, but I'm getting a little tired of the same thing of having to spam your friends and trying to get your friends to send you something in the game or trying to recruit new people to the game. You get a little tired of that. You only have so many Facebook friends. So I think there's going to be a little bit of fatigue there.
One of Groupon's big problems was that it was very easy to copy that business model. You saw other sites like Living Social and everything else under the sun for each little niche demographic. What about Zynga? Do they face that problem? Couldn't anybody make games that are really popular on mobile devices and online?
Yes, definitely. You see a lot of companies doing that now, such as Electronic Arts. You know, they're a very big game manufacturer, and they brought out the Sims Social, and you could see a lot of the same influences where you need to ask your friends for help. The idea is it's very viral. You know, you start playing a game, you want to get a little bit further into it, you're going to have to get some of your friends to play the game with you. So you can see a lot of other game developers being influenced by that. But at the same time, Zynga has a very distinct sort of a niche because their brand is very, very strong in that field in social media. So a lot of customers are very comfortable with the word, with the brand Zynga. I think moving forward, you're going to see a lot of similar products, but I think customers will stay loyal to Zynga versus, say, the Groupon model where, hey, if you find a great deal in a restaurant, it doesn't really matter who provides that to you, whether it's Groupon or Living Social or what.
I'm going to ask you one more question, Dan, if I may, before we let you go. Will social gaming companies, do you think, ever make as much money as traditional gaming companies, you know, Electronic Arts, Activision, those places?
I think the question's more, it might be how much their overhead is, right? Because the traditional games that you speak of, you require sometimes development teams in the size of hundreds. It might take them 3-4 years to deliver a product, and you have to deal with physical manufacturing, retail shelf space, splitting the cost with your distributors and the retailers and all of that sort of stuff. Whereas when you're talking about online social game and everything's hosted on servers, you don't have to deal with a lot of those problems. So you can make a game for a lot less. And if it grows virally, you know, that's less advertising and marketing that you'll need to worry about. So I think that's really the future. With Zynga games, for example, you're not selling any product up front. You could play it for free. You could play it indefinitely for free. Where they make money is through a lot of microtransactions. So they got to get those raw numbers in and hope a lot of those people want to spend a little bit of money here and there. And that all adds up for companies like Zynga. But their overhead for games like that are it's so low that it's a really good business model.
Well, Dan Hsu, who is editor of bitmob.com, joining us this morning from San Francisco. Dan, thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And finally, Steve, to a woman outside Chicago who recently decided to get her son Daniel a savings account at the bank to teach him fiscal responsibility.
Nice.
Yeah, I remember when I got my first savings account at the bank, and I was very excited when I first got a letter in the mail saying that I had gotten, you know, 5 cents interest or something like that.
I had a bank book.
Yeah.
Did you have a bank book?
I didn't. Yes, I did. I did have a bank book.
Yeah, a bank book.
That's right. Keep track the old-fashioned
way.
Or
as my grandmother used to call it, banca buca.
Well, according to the Chicago Tribune, Steve, this kid in Chicago, he let the balance on his new account drop down to about $5.
Mm.
So he was hit with a fee for not having enough money in the account.
Where this is going.
And
oh,
then
no.
So he overdrew because of the fee, and then he got hit with another fee. Every day the account was overdrawn. Long story short, he racked up $229 in fees on his new account.
Wow.
And when asked what the lesson from the experience is, he said, don't trust banks. So I don't think that guy's going to be...
I had a friend back in high school. He actually wrote a check for a pack of cigarettes. This is when I was in high school so long ago. Cigarettes were like $1.25 or something like that. He wrote a check for it. He bounced the check. And because of the insufficient fund charges and all that, he wound up paying like $48 for a pack of cigarettes. Which is
That'll
crazy.
Teach him to quit smoking.
He still smokes to this very day.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis, non-smoker, by the way. In Los Angeles, thanks for being with us. Have a great Monday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.